Our seventh case for argument today is United States against Vega Carrillo.
Good morning.
Mr. Goldberg.
May it please the court, I'm Daryl Goldberg. I'm here for the appellant Alexandro Vega Carrillo in this matter. This appeal, Your Honors, presents two issues, or really one issue and some subsets, and that's whether or not his sentence in his criminal case was either procedurally or substantively unreasonable. And, of course, if Your Honors were to find that there was procedural error, then you won't have to address whether or not there was substantive error. So I'm going to start with the procedural error in this particular case. And there are many ways to find or commit procedural error. I'm going to focus on two today, which is, one, selecting a sentence based on clearly erroneous facts, and secondly, treating the guidelines as mandatory. So in this case, to begin, Mr. Vega Carrillo's sentence was procedurally unreasonable because the district court, it relied upon inaccurate information regarding Mr. Vega Carrillo's desire to return to Mexico and raise his daughter over there. Because it's clear from the record he's going to be deported. He's now considered an aggravated felon. He's undocumented, committed this offense, and there's a detainer on him as we speak. So he made it clear, and his position was consistent all along in his interview with the probation officer for the pre-sentence interview, in his position paper to the court, in his arguments at his sentencing hearing, and his allocution, albeit through counsel, that he's looking forward to returning home and raising his family, starting afresh on his family's farm in Mexico. In other words, he went so far as to tell the probation officer, and this is in the pre-sentence report, I believe on pages 8 or 9, that it's an impossibility for me to come back here. I will never return to the United States. Because, and that was in the context of discussing raising his child back in Mexico. So the problem in this case is that when the district court it based its sentence on this faulty premise that Mr. Vega Carrillo is at a risk to return to the United States illegally. And it's completely divorced. It's entirely contrary to the record before the court.
Your view is that district judges, as a matter of law, must believe any self-serving statement a defendant makes? That would be extraordinary.
Your Honor, there has to be, respectfully, some evidence to suggest that he will come back here. He doesn't have to take everything accepted wholesale.
The rate of return by criminal aliens is documentable. It's very high. Now, your client says, I'm not going to be among them. Why does the district judge have to believe that?
Your Honor, what he did say is that I adopt and I accept the pre-sentence report. And he also said...
The pre-sentence report, by the way, concluded that an awful lot of what your client had said was false, or to be kinder, non-verifiable.
Your Honor, I would suggest that if the difference is that the independent of the pre-sentence report, independent of buying it wholesale, you're essentially saying I'm going to sentence any deportable alien who's committed a felony offense in the United States based upon this speculation that they will return. There's nothing specific. These are individual-based sentences, not just sentencing a class of undocumented aliens. He also said in his remarks when imposing sentence that he accepted the arguments that were made by the defense. And in fact, he went so far, the district court judge, to say, I accept it all and I agree with them except for the fact that this is a serious offense.
If he got a shorter sentence, where would his daughter be?
His daughter is going to join him in Mexico.
Well, he isn't in Mexico. I mean, he's arguing for a shorter sentence, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and he wants, because his co-defendant who cooperated got less, so he thinks he ought to get some less. But his main argument is, well, I'm going to be out of here anyway. So why would you want to hold me here? Because I can go back to the farm and, take his daughter with him? Or where's the mother?
Mother's in Chicago.
And with the daughter.
With the daughter.
And is she going back as soon as he goes in prison, or is she going to wait around?
No, she'd love to return to Mexico with him and raise the daughter on the family's farm.
I see.
That was the point, and maybe I'm...
What he's basically saying is, let me out early, and I'm going to take the wife and kid and go back to Mexico. What the concern is, he's going to go back to Mexico and come back here. So that's why this dispute.
Well, I understand that. I understand what the judge... I don't want to say concluded. I understand that whether he misunderstood the position before him or just didn't accept it, it's unclear. But I think that everything before the judge, and to point out what Judge Eastberg said, he doesn't have to accept it wholesale, and he doesn't have to buy into Mr. Vega Carrillo's position. But he did say, and this is where maybe there was some misunderstanding, that I agree or I accept everything that's been presented to me, and I agree with defense counsel, but except this is a very serious case. And now there's this great risk, this grave risk, that Mr. Vega Carrillo is coming back to the United States. And that's not what has been before him in any capacity. It was, at least it attempted to be clear, and I suppose what makes this case a little unique is that the allocution was actually given through me as the trial counsel, because Mr. Vega Carrillo was so, he's a timid fellow. But the judge nevertheless said he accepted what the representations to him and the proffers to him. And that's his, he can't wait to get home. He's incredibly remorseful. He learned from his mistakes. He enjoys sobriety while he's in custody, and he's suffered tremendously. And so because of that, whether you look at this as either relying on inaccurate information.
Almost all defendants claim to be remorseful, but recidivism remains high. Right? Your whole argument seems to be that district judges are legally obliged to be credulous. Whatever the defendant tells them, they must believe, and sentences must be based on those assertions.
Well, no, I'm going to...
That would certainly be a revolution in criminal sentencing.
Of course, what I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that in this case, and I can quote the judge, it's in the brief and it's in the record, certainly is that he's saying, I accept what's been told to me.
Yeah, but your whole point is the judge didn't. The judge then said, there's a risk you'll return.
Correct.
And which means the judge did not accept his assurance that he would certainly, absolutely, positively never do that.
Right. So then I guess the question is whether he misunderstood something, relied upon inaccurate information, or just his remarks were clearly inconsistent. In other words, whether there's a substantial chance that the district court's misapprehension of a sentencing factor played into the actual sentence. And... That's a scenario where this court has said it would reverse and remand for a new one.
But the sentence is at the bottom of the advisory guidelines, right?
It is. It is.
And his co-defendant got less for the same crime because he cooperated, I guess, and testified. And that's why he got less.
Well, that's another problem that I raise, and I'll try to explain this. I believe that the judge treated the guidelines as mandatory in this case, because one of the things that I raised with the court was that really this is a case where there's nothing that the co-defendant did to substantially assist the government. In other words, he was just the first one to proffer. This is a case where the evidence...
You genuinely think that Judge Guzman doesn't understand or has never read Booker?
No.
When a criminal defendant said, oh, that judge thought the guidelines were mandatory, you're accusing the judge of being an idiot. We don't believe our judges are idiots.
Your Honor, I'm not calling Judge Guzman an idiot, and I respect
him
tremendously.
Yes, you are. You're saying 8 years after Booker, this judge simply doesn't understand the law, despite the fact that he's read it thousands of times. Just doesn't get it.
Your Honor, I would...
Doesn't get what a first-year law student knows.
Your Honor, I'm going so far to say is that people aren't perfect, and perhaps when he inquired of the parties and he wanted to know, looked at his notes, and he wanted to know about what the other co-defendants were sentenced to in this particular case, one of the things that at least I read it to be is that he felt that his hands were somewhat tied. And he said his words were something along the lines was, it's unfortunate that the defendant was not immediately forthcoming in his determination to help the government. And that there's nothing in the record to suggest that. The only thing that's before the court was that it took some time to conduct a safety valve proffer, but that was just based upon scheduling constraints of counsel. Because initially, if I recall correctly, I was engaged in a lengthy trial, and then it was Mr. Baker and the co-prosecutor, Ms. Cecilla, were engaged in some trials. And so what we decided to do, I think collectively, was he pled guilty, we do the safety valve proffer later. But the reason why I'm comfortable saying that there wasn't much that this co-defendant did to substantially assist the government is because this case is on tape, not to speak in cliches, but they were caught red-handed. And so there was nothing that he could do that would push the case along, induce pleas. There wasn't anything that really benefited the government. It just happened to be a matter of timing. And so when the judge said, inquired and said, essentially, this is an 11C1C plea for the co-defendant, I accepted it, and the guideline range was originally the same.
Well, Judge Guzman said that it's unfortunate this defendant was not immediately forthcoming in his determination to help the government in this case. He's saying that, you know, he held back, thinking maybe it might not be as bad. And then finally, after his co-defendant decided to cooperate, and he did.
And Your Honor, I read that differently because the reality, what was presented to the court by what I presented to the court and what there was no objection by the government, essentially, was that the only thing that happened is we waited for some discovery to come in that had to see a video of a transaction. That's really it. He gave Mr. Vega Carrillo in this matter gave a post-arrest statement. He talked extensively about his involvement in this offense, and he ultimately the government never disputed that he was a very candid in the safety valve proffer. So again, it's a question of
it shows immediately acceptance of responsibility for the offense. Right.
And I suppose then that as a lawyer, if you advise a client, go and immediately proffer to the government, plead guilty, and agree to cooperate.
Well, that may not necessarily be malpractice. That's one of the options. If that would have been the case here, you wouldn't be before us making this argument, would you?
Probably not. But another point.
But it's an alternative. I mean, you can say, well, I'll go with the roll of the dice, or I'll make my admission. And he just made his a little later, which put him outside of the safety valve.
Well, no, he was in the safety valve, but
outside of
the 5K motion. Right, and so, Your Honor, but one thing that's significant, at least from my perspective, is that whether it doesn't make much sense, in other words, it doesn't promote respect for the law, where someone who receives a 5K1 motion gets a particular sentence when they're more culpable. Because the facts of this case are that the one who received 46 months, the co-defendant, was responsible for actually procuring the drugs, transporting money, and then ultimately doing the same delivery as Mr. Vega Carrillo. So to receive a 46-month sentence and be more involved...
We have your position, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Baker.
May it please the Court, Stephen Baker on behalf of the United States. The District Court was very clear in its summary of the facts of the case. It did not err in its recitation of those facts or its understanding. As the Court pointed out, the District Court actually didn't even go so far as to presume what would happen with regard to the defendant in this case. The District Court simply noted there was a powerful motive for this defendant to come back to the United States, which I think is clear on the record, and the District Court said it is taught by experience, which I think is true. Additionally, the District Court understood that it had the power to sentence outside the guideline range. That is clear from its language as it considers whether to sentence inside the guideline range or without. It did not abuse its discretion at all in this sentence. Also, Your Honors, the defendant was similarly situated except for the cooperation with his co-defendant. And the District Court took into consideration all three of the defendants in this conspiracy and set aside sentences in accord with both their cooperation and their culpability. And it was well within its discretion in doing that. If the Court has no further questions for the United States, we would ask you to affirm the sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Goldberg, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement.